Accession number 18642, Reel 2.
Because he's got some problems. He's got to advance across a lot of Dutch territory. And the Dutch naturally don't want the town destroyed by artillery and bombing and all their dikes destroyed. And you've got to get them across that area and go and have a talk with General Crerar. And so I had a talk with General Crerar and some of the other General Simmons and so on, I got there. And I said we have 700 French SAS and we'll drop them as a carpet in front of you. And so they'll blow the bridges on either side and they will capture the bridges so as to make you a line right across the canal country. And this is what this article's about. And we dropped them through 10th cloud at 1500 feet at night on a G fix, which was rather narrow one, so it's a bit inaccurate. And but it's very inaccuracy made for sort of security, and we dropped amongst them battle simulators which went bang 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 brook boom like for 24 hours, you see, and which confused the enemy, also confused ourselves a bit. But the idea was the Canadians had crossed this river Isel, which is really the extension of the Rhine, and part of one of the extensions of the Rhine. And they would be overrun within probably 96 hours, some of them 48 hours. Well, I was knowing how regular armies, how slow they go, I got over my Belgian SAS and some of the British SAS, had committed most of them, and the Canadian army was slow. I think one thing is they got too much loot, and then what excuse they made was they were the Second Army, the British Army, was given priority and on the roads and so on. Like that. The French were dancing about. We'd committed them, and so I went in ahead with the Belgians. And then I had meant to drop the jeeps at a certain time after they'd arrived to the French, but my second in command wouldn't do it. I put the blame on the SAS in that article, but they said that they might get lost, you see. Well, it didn't matter that time of war when they did get lost or this, that, and the other. But the French were always a bit angry they never got their armoured jeeps. But what we did do is with the Belgians went forward very, very well, and and I also got a Polish artillery battery with me. And I'd also been in touch with the Canadian Air Force and said, I bet you can't do close air support as well as we have in Burma, and so stirred them on. And the group captain used to lead the attacks, you see, and he gave us most marvellous support. And he also, we talked to them from ground to air, which was sort of forbidden in Europe. It wasn't done, you see, what we did as we'd done. And so we... Was that article I had? Now you may think this is too much like regular warfare, but we went right across there. See, this shows the hole. This is where the Second Army was going. I did attend the Rhine crossing. I'll show it down here somewhere. I was at the Rhine crossing and again walked over to both sides and found the third, first, first airborne. We're just the Second Army weren't contacting them, and everybody was worried about another Arnhem. So I was told to go in by General Gale. I flew in and landed. The aircraft, our own aircraft, a light aircraft, just twisted its propeller. But so I had to walk back, and I walked back, and a bit worried about mines, because we couldn't have all this mine problem in Burma. And I got back to the farm front. Platoons and things like that, not going forward. And I said, why didn't you go forward? And he said, it was the enemy. We've had very heavy casualties. I said, there's no enemy. I just walked back. And he said, we've had heavy casualties. I said, what sort of casualties? He said, we've had three of our Bren carriers blown up on mines. And I said, but there's no enemy there. He said, no, no. But it stopped the whole advance, you see. So I went back through company commander, battalion commander, and found the brigade was still the other side of the Rhine, even though they'd got three battalions across. And this is a thing to be unheard of in Burma by, you know, after our defeat there. People had learnt that brigadiers went in front, you know, yeah, and not led from behind. And I remember telling General Gale, and we had those American generals who would command the Allied Airborne Army. He later was commander in Korea. And I saw his scorn when I was telling this about the British, but it's true, they weren't getting a move on. And this is what we were, you know, the SAS was injected in order to get the whole army to get moving, you see what I mean? It was useful. It's amazing how few people can do that. And so I think that this was a good SAS job. Anyway, you couldn't refuse it. You got orders. There was a bit of tug of war, as you'll see in there, when the airborne forces wanted to take over the SAS,
yes,
and didn't realise that the SAS had special jobs of its own. But it's very easy, and the SAS can make this mistake of using secrecy to avoid doing what they don't like, you see to me. I've always said, like I was a Royal Engineer, and we were taught that we must never consider ourselves precious. We can get other people to consider us precious. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
But if we, were a chisel and we were asked to act as a screwdriver, we mustn't say no. We must do it. And this I've always said about the SAS. And then the French did their stuff. And they did very, very well indeed. They were marvellous in attack. Everybody said, well, gosh, the casualties they had, this, that, and the other. In fact, the answer was, differently, was to stop them. They want to go on to Berlin, you see, on their own. And we only had about 30 killed in an operation of that nature. We covered right across there, you see. To a certain amount of bluff, I went in with a union, with a bloody great roll from the Union Jack on it, just bowing to everyone, as if the thing is finished, you see. Not an awful lot of Germans just immediately surrendered, and the resistance all bounced up. We didn't tell the resistance because they weren't safe, you see. They'd been penetrated. But as soon as they'd seen this, we went through until we had this final battle up here at Winchcurton. That is a parachute battalion held out. I put the Belgians into that, and we took that. That meant we had this road all the way around here. As the road crosses the Zuider Zee, and this meant that there was a lot of Germans left in there, the Amsterdam area. And so these chaps got through here first. There's not much in it in the official histories, but it's all there in the original thing.
Lunch?
Yes. Give you a copy of this.
I can get a copy, it's okay.
Can you?
Yes, no problem.
102.
Yeah. The
Going on to the...
Oh, I'd like to talk about this what happened about the phone.
Yeah.
May I go on ahead?
That's a good idea, yeah.
Well, when we got back from Norway, I had malaria, and had plenty of time to think. And there was a question of what would be the future of the SAS. We had been going to go out to the Far East and drop into, the general plan was drop into Thailand at the same time as the attack on the Malayan coast. And there was only one division, Jap division, in the whole of Thailand. And the idea was there would be going to be a revolt of the Siamese army, whatever that would be like, and the British and French SAS would try and be the nodal point of that revolt, and might extend into Indochina. The problem there was of what you call them in union things, of boundaries between MacArthur going north and Mountbatten coming south, you see.
Yeah.
I think Thailand came into MacArthur, into Mountbatten's area. But then the atom bomb was dropped, and we had to think again. Now, I reckoned that this was the right way to think about the future. First of all, was there a requirement for the SAS in time of war? I suggested there was a requirement, especially at the beginning of a war, when small forces might be able to start revolts or do raids or slow down the advance of a potential enemy. And therefore, if there was a requirement, if it was agreed there was a requirement in a war, how should the spirit and prestige and also expertise of the SAS and other special forces be preserved between the two wars? And I want to make it quite clear, I looked at this point of view from the wider angle, that the SAS was only one, possibly the best one, of a number of special forces which have been raised in different theatres of war with varying success. Well, I suggested that whatever the force it was, we call it the SAS, what I did suggest was that it should be called, have a generic term of SAS, and then should have a local word for where the actual operations were, so that if it was in Southeast Asia, it could be one word. I suggested was the South Pacific Rangers, SAS Regiment, or if it was in Arabia, it could be some similar name, SAS Regiment. Because I thought the SAS Regiment had got a very, very good organization, signal setup, and background, and so on like that, to form a regiment. Well then, was there a job for a regular force? I didn't think it probably could be justified for a regular force in peacetime. But I did think, and I'm rather proud of having thought of it, that I thought there'd be an awful lot of trouble all over the world, and there would be a counterinsurgency job which could be given to the SAS in peacetime. Until that time came, I recommended that there should be three squadrons formed, and they should be based on the universities of Oxford, Cambridge, and London. My arguments I gave for that is I'd be very much impressed when I was at Cambridge of the University Air Squadron in Cambridge before the war, which produced a very, very fine lot of of flyers, also an awful lot of them reached high rank. And my idea for choosing those three universities was that they were evenly placed. They all had, presumably the people who went there were intelligent. I thought that was important. There's plenty of time for sport and keeping fitness, and I think that's very important. And thirdly, they had long vacations, 6 months, when they could do two or three things which would improve their expertise for SAS operations. One is they could learn languages. Two, they could visit countries on archaeological digs, whatever it was, so they make themselves expert in, or knowledgeable of certain countries and theatres of possible theatres of war. And three, they would meet people who had that international outlook and that objective outlook, which I think is very important for the SAS. This was...
This officer, I'll just turn over the tape. Okay, marvellous.
Well then, this... what happened was, I wrote to... the CIGS, Lord Allenbrook, in those terms, and said, I think there should be an SAS unit, and I gave him those arguments, and I suggested that an investigation should be made. You'll see it mentioned in my file there, that somebody should investigate the whole thing, and I made the point, which I consider very important, that that the commanders and chief and chief of staff of our enemies should be in their interrogations, they all got long interrogations, that a special section of interrogation should be devoted to asking what were the effects of operations of small forces against them. I understand this was done, and they all, with very famous names, came out and said the units like the SAS had had a very great effect, in some cases a decisive effect on some of the campaigns.
Who conducted that report?
Who wrote it? Mm. Well, now, the chap who was chosen was the Director of Tactical Investigation. That's a bit of paper I had. I wrote these names down. These people I forget. I had it before we left.
No problem, we can do it on the phone.
Sorry. I'm going to switch off.
Yeah, okay. Going again.
The Director of Tactical Investigation at that time was General Rowell, Lieutenant General, I think, or Major General Rowell, Rowell, who had fought on the Kokoda Trail and done very well. Mm-hmm. He also fought in the Middle East, but he was the first person in history almost to defeat the Japanese under stressful circumstances. And he later became Chief of General Staff of the Australian Army. He had a man of original ideas, and he had a row with Blaney, who was a very rigid traditionalist. But he had, as his second command, was a Brigadier Churchill. I had no relation, I understand, but he was also very much a clued-up person. And they, Lord Allenbrook told them to do the investigation. And since the war, as I anticipated, the very cold wind of economy swept down, and there would be a cry out to get rid of all the latest regiments on the sort of assumption that last in, first out. And sure enough, there have been attempts to get rid of the SAS, like they have a parachute regiment under the commandos. And this report has been produced, and it's filled with such important names from both sides. Mm-hmm. Because I also wrote to many commander-in-chiefs that I either knew or the chiefs of staff, and said, I'm writing this. I gave them a copy of my letter and said, this is being done. Would you please give all the help you can and write down anything? And then I put up my possible suggestion as something to disagree with, if necessary. Yeah. And I don't know whether I can expand on that, but that was the main idea. They did try out this, and they thought about this university idea, but I think at the time I heard that it was the universities who turned it down. And then they had this problem, what to do with the artist rifles, and whether it was Brown Franks or not, they had this idea of maintaining the SAS as attached to the artist rifles. The advantage of that was that the artist rifles were like-minded people, intelligent people, and they'd also got a, they also were rich, and they got plenty of silver plate and all that, so people could dine and do all sorts of things which Territorial Army people like doing. And they had a drill hall and community near the city and so on. Okay.
It would have been necessary to attach yourself to a regiment.
I don't know where it was, but it makes it much easier.
Yeah.
In forming a regiment in wartime, you come across a great number of problems, administrative problems and this, that and the other. To form it in peacetime, like I did the 22nd SAS, is absolute hell, because the important thing is to have a good quartermaster and a good adjutant and a good RSM and a good chief clerk, yeah, and so on of that nature, who knows records. They've got to deal with records and all sorts of people like that. And then you have a match 22 problem. They say you can't have that until you've got 200 men. And then you said, well, how can I raise and train 200 men if I haven't got these people? They said, oh, well, you can get them as soon as you get the others, you see. And so it's very, very difficult to start a thing. There's all the accounting of clothing, and there's the G1098, that's the, all the lists of equipment and so on of that nature. And it's very easy for me to have got completely engulfed. I'd been an adjutant a number of times, and I knew quite a lot about this, but I could have all my time taken up. I've never worked so hard in my life as forming the 22nd SAS in Malaya later, because I had to do the training, the administration. I had to attend top-level conferences, and I had to do recruiting, like going to Rhodesia and Hong Kong and Singapore, all at the same time. And then all the time I had on my neck General Urquhart and others saying, when are you going to show results? What is this beautiful new thing you form? Why aren't you killing people like that? And it was very, very difficult. Also, it looked untidy, but I always say to them, my excuse for that is that a building site doesn't look very pretty. Mm. So whilst you're building up a new unit, it doesn't look very pretty until you've got the landscape gardeners and the interior decorators in and so on. But and I had this problem. And in those books which you've seen, they said it started off with a bad beginning. In actual fact, the question of discipline, we had no military police charges against us whatsoever. We have a reunion of the, I'm jumping on this, really, on what was called the Malayan Scouts, 22nd SAS, and they're very indignant about some of the things said in those books, because I don't think those people knew what had happened. They never came to speak to me. They never came to speak to any of the people who took part.
Which is very interesting, that, because I mean, it's the same in a lot of the books. Once somebody's sowed the seed of an idea, everyone accepts it.
Everyone copies it, yes. Well, John Woodhouse, who acted as my adjutant and became a first company commander, he has written, not complete, but he has written an account of the start of the 22nd SAS. He lives down in Dorset.
That's I was going to see him, but he just came out of hospital.
Hospital, yes. I want to know how he is, because he was in great pain last time I spoke to him.
Our problem is that
he comes after 1947.
47, yeah. I mean, we've got problems if we go beyond, yes, we've got big problems if we go past 47.
Well, the point is this, is I will go a little way past it, but by saying this, is that I then left, as all regulars do, to a new posting which was in India. And I visited Afghanistan and things. And then I went through the staff college. And then the Korean War broke out. I was in Trieste there on the government. And then I went out to Hong Kong, where I was G1 air. And then I was sent for by General Harding on General Slim's recommendation that he wanted me to do a reconnaissance of the whole of Malaya and write a report about it. I was allowed to go anywhere I liked and look at any files I liked. And I wrote my report, which I used to write interim reports to General Harding. I wrote my report, about 46 pages, and I gave 12 recommendations. I was then sent back to England, where I met, they put, not the Minister of Defence, but the colonial minister, and I'm going to forget his name, and I realised I only had about an hour with him, and I said, I've got about 12 points here. I said, none of them are any good unless you agree with the first one. And he said, what's the first one? And I said, there must be one man with one plan and given the powers to carry it out. And he said, all right. And I got on with my other 10 points, one of which was to form a special counterinsurgency force which would live, move, and have its being in the jungle alongside, in the same bloodstream as the guerrilla, so that they would meet, and if they were well trained enough and smart enough, well armed enough, and would beat. I said possibly the casualties would probably be only one for one to begin with. And then I said, that's my 11th point. Now the 12th point is, I said again, unless you do this, none of the others are any good. And he said, what is that? And I said, there must be one man, one plan, and powers to carry it out. He said, who do you suggest? My first suggestion was Casey, later Lord Casey, who had been governor, brought in as governor of Bengal when the whole of Bengal was in eruption in 1942, and he helped put it down again. He's an Australian. I thought he'd come out with new ideas and so on. And he said, no, supposing it's a serviceman. And I said, now I have a feeling somebody had placed this name in my brain. And I said, if I was a griller, the chap whom I'd be most frightened of, because he